Well, welcome, everybody. Thaddeus, nice to see you here.
Likewise.
President Harrison, nice to have you joining us this evening. I'd like to call our Grand Junction Regional Airport Authority meeting for March 1st, special board meeting, to order. Thank you, everybody that's attending this evening. Generally, we would have a roll call, but we know that Commissioner Taggart is in another meeting this evening, and everybody else is present, is identified here tonight. So thank you all for your attending. But we do have some staff members that are joining us, I think, remotely, or all of our staff here?
We're all here.
Okay.
We have our staff here. We also have Jeremy Lee as an extension of staff, of course, here to answer questions, and Dan Reimer on the phone.
Yep, our counsel, Dan Reimer, is on the phone with us, or is that Reimer? Okay, excuse me. And Jeremy Lee and Sam Siebold, I see, are with us this evening as well. So thank you. Nice to have your attendance here this evening. So we'll go forward with a quick Pledge of Allegiance, if you'll join me with that.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Couple of lines in the pledge that make you think a little bit about what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. Liberty and justice for all. Let's hope that continues to be felt and where it needs to be. So, all right, we'll go through a quick approval of the agenda. Staff, is there any changes to our agenda this evening as presented? Okay, thank you. Commissioners, any comments on the agenda? I think we don't have anything for consent. We have one action item and two discussion items in our executive session this evening. So I would entertain a motion for the approval of the agenda as presented.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. Thank you very much.
We're a fishing person, gentlemen.
Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same side. Motion carries. Thank you. Commission comments this evening. That's thinking.
I had something, and now I forget what it was.
All right. While you're thinking, I will, as Angela mentioned earlier, congratulations to staff that made a great presentation for the Westar expansion here at the airport. That's pretty exciting.
Yes.
Will they be building the new building over here on the east side, kind of adjacent to some of their existing, or are they remodeling another hangar?
Yes. So the site where they'd like to build is on their existing leasehold. So it's kind of in the back corner, a site that, you know, you all are likely unfamiliar with. We've been out there about 1,000 times in the last 2 years to talk about this. So we're familiar, and we're working closely with them to make sure that meets our design specifications and that they can get the most out of that site, you know, given the constraints we have. So.
I think you probably all saw that article, 70 employees, 53,000 average wage. That's very significant for this community, so it's mm-hmm. good news. Well done for making that happen for them.
Team sport and our economic development partners really came through. So.
I think the Chamber through IDI and GGF did a match that helped out with the state grant, that type of thing. So.
And importantly, at the state level, they really championed it. So we were in a supporting role for sure.
That's great.
Dylan, hats off for getting the snow removed in a relatively surprised snowstorm. Came in from Wyoming based upon the direction it was blowing. So.
Yeah, thank you. It's a team effort. Also, kudos to Ben on the front side, too. And the people show up at 5 in the morning, but they're not sitting around for all of our sidewalks either. So.
I did notice all that salt. Well done. And that was 60 degrees outside.
There was a fair amount of ice out there. So
yeah.
Our team just flipped it down. But it was Dylan's folks throwing sand or the ice on the runway, or my folks throwing stuff out front. Trying to keep it as safe as possible.
Awesome.
Great. Any other commissioner comments this evening?
I remembered what it was. I was thinking about, maybe it was a year or so ago, that we briefly had a hoopla about whether or not we love being out here at the end of the day. And I felt, Tom, like you have taken the reins of making this meeting happen efficiently enough that we might consider doing a lunch meeting again. And just throw it out there for consideration. We used to go for hours and hours and hours, and I feel like we're pretty good at knowing how long things are going to take, and maybe it would make sense. I don't know if people are interested in doing a nooner, or we might have more community involvement. I don't know.
Right, during the day.
Yeah. And my schedule, I've been reviewing my own schedule, and I notice I'm a little bit hit or miss lately, and I personally, I don't like missing these meetings. I really like being here. So I just thought I'd throw it out there.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. And I think we had a little bit of discussion around everybody's ability to attend that sometime differently than 5 o'clock. And there was a little bit of a bump, I think, with Commissioner Taggart's schedule, but I don't remember if we asked him specifically about noon.
Right. That's so. A spot where if somebody did want to sneak over and just hear or rattle their saber or whatever the thing is, that
right.
It's a little bit more of an open slot in people's day.
Yeah, you bet.
So, anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Just thought I'd throw it out there.
Sure. We'll circle back around and see how that kind of plays out.
Sure.
All right. Anything else this evening? Okay. Cameron, do we have any citizen comments this evening?
No, Mr. Chairman, we do not have any citizen comments tonight.
And it looks like we do have a citizen joining us. Nice to have you here.
Hi, how are you guys?
And you're with?
KLEX-5.
All right, great station. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
All right, welcome. Okay, since we don't have a consent agenda, there's no need to have a motion for approval of the consent agenda this evening, but we do have some action items, and we'll move into that as we are now for the reimbursable agreement for the FAA for temporary navigational aid design and construction associated with the runway 1230 relocation request. And is that going to be Jeremy doing that, or is that you, Angela? Are you leading
us? I can kick it off, and then Jeremy can answer questions. Great. So.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I took them.
This one? Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Sarah. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, sorry for the confusion on Friday. You know, we knew that if we sent the agenda out early, we'd magically get this agreement we've been waiting on for 9 months from the FAA, and we're eager to get it approved. So thanks for your flexibility, and sorry if it was confusing. But essentially, this agreement, first, I want you to know this is not a grant agreement. Usually our FAA agreements are grant agreements. This is an agreement where we are basically hiring the FAA, but the tech ops team in the FAA, to relocate their navigational aids. So only they are allowed to touch those. And so that's the team that needs to move them. So they are the contractor. They need to be, you know, that work needs to be funded. We do anticipate it will be funded through our grant. But the grants, when grants are administered, they can't be directly granted within the FAA, right? They have to be granted to airports for work at airports. So the grant will come to us, and then we will pay the tech ops team. And that gets into governance at the federal level for, you know, pretty obvious governance, right? You know, you don't want the FAA being able to take that airport improvement program money and divvy it within the FAA. You know, it needs to, there need to be some checks and balances. So essentially, this is to fund the design and construction for relocating most of the nav aids as part of our runway relocation project. This is a small but absolutely critical part of the project. I say small in scale and dollars, but really an outsized impact on the operation and importance. And this is absolutely critical path when it comes to the runway project at this time. And, you know, there's a lot of risk, obvious risk in relocating nav aids and in the schedule involved, you know, so we're eager to get this agreement in place so that Jeremy and team can be working with that nav aid group to design where those go as part of all the other design work that's happening. And we can really get that moving so that we can maintain schedule for the runway relocation project. So what you have before you is an agreement with us and the ATO group within the FAA that we will reimburse them for expenses incurred for this work. If you have any questions, we have Jeremy to answer because I'm out of information that I can provide.
Thank you. Angela, appreciate the commentary. Jeremy, would you like to add a couple more things here?
Along the FAA staff to work in parallel with our design team in relocating the threshold of 1129. It also takes advantage of quite a bit of ongoing work in the region with procedures in airspace, really hopefully only changing the runway condition one time between now and when we actually shift over to the future new runway.
Technical questions for Jeremy?
Actually, I do, Jeremy. In there, we're designing the relocation of the glide slope, but there's no mentioning of the localizer. Is that, I guess I'm curious to why that is.
The existing localizer is located at the west end of 1129 and will not be impacted by the grading or the embankment of the new runway. So we're able to protect that infrastructure. They will tune the localizer based on the envelope of it, but it will be tuned in place as part of this work.
So when they then remove the glide slope, we'll just descend to a localizer only approach, I guess, for a while with the LPDs and whatever else we have?
That's a great question, Paul. Our current work with the FAA has identified we will transition the localizer out, maintaining visual vertical guidance with PAPI, and we will be installing new PAPIs, which will commission immediately with the new runway threshold, and then flight check the glide slope at the time the new runway threshold is commissioned. So there will be a period without glide slope, but we will maintain visual vertical control, and of course, other automated controls are clear on key procedures.
Okay, and on the MALS, are we going to, is that a loaner system, the MALS F?
We are in the interim condition relocating parts of the MALS R system, but we are reducing its size down to a MALS F, a flashing system, for the duration of the development of the new runway. But we will transition back to a MALS R system with the final new runway conditions. It's looking at your procedures, it doesn't actually significantly impact your minimums to do that. But our intention is to restore the MALS R in the long term.
Right. Well, and our LPDs and the other RNAV approaches are really good in here. So, okay. Yes. Well, I was just curious.
Thanks, Jeremy. I think Thaddeus and Erling probably understand the terminology that was there.
I guess the better way that's why I started.
I guess the better way to ask the question might be, is the FAA going to be happy with us with this transition as we work through it?
Yes. That's a great question. I understand that question.
Okay. We'll take that. Thank you, Jeremy. Is affirmative.
And
that there's no risk to the passenger travel while we're doing these adjustments.
So this puts us on the path really to more to really firm up what the impacts are for us. You know, I think we're on a good path to minimize impacts to the airlines and to the other pilots. But it will put us on a path to where we can really firm up what those are. We can try to optimize the timing. You know, given weather differences throughout the year, things like that. And work with the airlines so they can proactively make sure that the aircraft that are coming in here are equipped to handle that. Because sometimes it's really simple swaps for them. But right now, it's too general, right? Those conversations for us to be able to really refine details.
Okay. So. Speaking of which, if it's localizer only, I don't know. Is it substantially higher than minimums? Would that affect our miss?
Yeah.
I mean, 1,000 feet maybe? Or?
Oh, I think it's 600 localizer only. But I think most of the airlines, they can do RNAV approaches now. They may, not a lot of them can do LPV approaches. The LPV is essentially, it's not technically a precision approach, but in a practical scheme, it is. So you have a GPS and equipment on the aircraft that'll take you down to the same aisle as minimums.
Really?
Yeah, okay. We do that in hours. And that's, the airlines that can do that will transition to that, because not a lot of people fly localized approaches with the step down. And then the RNAV approaches is almost, I think it's 360 feet.
That's pretty low.
Down to. So we have some really, really good RNAV approaches.
So you don't agree that this is totally wasted money and we should just go back to pilotage and dead reckoning and not have any approach for a while?
The fact you're being filmed behind us.
I probably appreciate that, really.
Speaking of which, the $538,000 is—it's basically goes away because it's only a temporary. The FAA isn't subject to any procurement. We can't bid this against anybody. They're just telling us what it costs, and that's it.
Yeah. So, I mean, they are the ones who control their equipment. And so that's where, from a project management perspective, too, you know, they're good partners, but, you know, airports are also, you know, we're largely just working with them and under their guidance and direction. You know, we don't get to have a contract schedule. We don't. And so it's, you know, we're eager to get this going. I say we. There's no one in that we who's more eager than Jeremy to get this going so that we can have definition, we can work towards this because, right. You know, the stakes are high, really, and it's largely outside of our control, so we want to make sure that they are equipped to get this work done. Yeah. A question I have for the board related to this is, you know, as things get firmed up, would it be helpful? I mean, we're getting into a more technical phase in the runway project. Would it be helpful if in a workshop in the future we actually went over some of the basics on approaches and on the runway just so that, you know, you feel more informed? Or is that something where you're like, nope, you guys have it taken care of, we're out? We're good either way.
If it would be helpful for you to govern, like for us to help you govern, then yes, but I don't know that I need to know LVTs and RNSs and R.
Yeah. Well, that's
not going to be helpful. I'm going to be an impediment.
I guess I would encourage
governance.
Commissioners to maybe do a workshop with you or with Jeremy if they have.
Well, and if we have a workshop on the calendar that, you know, ultimately we don't have something critical to cover, maybe we'll slide that in there and just kind of the airfield 101 kind of thing to get questions out there and make it clear to commissioners so that if you're not very interested, you're like, I'm going to pass on that one. Have fun, guys.
Yeah, I would attend.
Okay.
Yeah. I would attend too. I think just because we have to understand how it works with the fiduciary responsibility we have. Yeah. And so I think that matters.
That's what I would say. Risks and liability, if they're above your threshold of what you think we understand and we need to have a better understanding of those risks, then I think that's when it's time for us to understand
that. Great.
The key word is that you already have done reaching out to the airlines so they can identify, because one airline may have a fleet that says 20% can do LPV, 60% can do RNAVs, and then the other 20% left or whatever, the mathematically, they can't do anything. Because if you reach out to them and tell them exactly what that they have here, what they will have, they can then plan and maybe spin other aircrafts in here that can do these operations.
Yep.
Okay. So we'll keep that in mind, because I think, you know, for this project and also as 29 Road Interchange gets built and as we really take a look at, you know, frontage road possibilities and things like that, I mean, I think it'll be important that you understand at a very high level approach is kind of how it works, what you're giving up if you, you know, give up space, things like that.
Yeah.
We'll plan that, but in a general way. And I can't talk about this as fluidly as Erling can, and I promise you won't be able to after that session either. But you'll at least, you know, at least we'll be able to follow.
Great. Thank you.
Feel free to, if I can help out with anything. You guys are doing well, but if I can help explain any of it, I'll be happy to.
Well, thank you.
All right, very good. Nice coverage on that from a technical perspective as well. Jeremy, thank you for your insights. I think we understand the scope of this enough. The time frame, Jeremy, would you give us a little bit of an idea of what your sense is of that?
Sure. Actually, we're working through a coordination schedule with the design team right now to start. The FAA is actually ready to be on site as soon as March 14th to start their airport design. Those design packages will be prepared in alignment with ours to bid later this summer, supporting, you know, potential end-of-year funding to construct the remaining parts of the relocated threshold. And then the actual relocation of the threshold will be in the summer of 2023 with the new procedure publication for 1129.
Okay, very good. With that in mind, is there any further questions for Angela or Jeremy? If not, entertaining a motion for the approval of item A, reimbursable agreement. Somebody would like to read that in their motion, the bolded point. We can include that as a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. I propose a motion to approve item A, reimbursable agreement with the Federal Aviation Administration for temporary NAV aid design and construction associated with the runway 1230 relocation project.
Second. Been moved and seconded. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. Appreciate that, Jeremy. Thanks for weighing in.
Tom, I just wanted to let you know, too, that Fred actually messaged us, too, and said that the GA community would probably like to attend that as well. I guess with that more technical information. So just wanted to point that out to the group. And I told him to make sure that they're included in that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we've been covering. You know, we meet quarterly with our GA tenants, and Colin is there for every meeting and presents on all the airfield projects. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Thank you, Fred. All right. Next item on our agenda is the leakage study presentation. Harrison, thanks for coming over for that. Appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
So, really nice to be here with everyone tonight. Thank you. So what I'm going to do this evening is walk through the study that we just concluded. When we say a leakage study or a catchment study, what we're doing is looking at defined geographic regions and looking at the travel demand within those regions, regardless of the airport they use. So this lets us understand, in our case, Mesa County and where people are going to and from, whether they're using the airport behind us or whether they're driving to Denver or Salt Lake or wherever. And so we'll explore that in detail. I'll talk you through a little bit of the data and the methodology, but then we're also going to zoom out. We defined seven other regions around Western Colorado and Eastern Utah to understand that demand. I'll kind of just put the reminder here. This was funded by the Air Service Alliance. And so their goal is to understand, you know, from their perspective, how they improve air service in the area and potentially draw those customers in from outlying regions, which is why we did kind of this extensive analysis beyond. Traditionally, for if an airport is funding this on their own, we tend to be a little closer in. They went and bought some extra data so we could go for a broader view. We'll talk through some opportunities and then tell you what we're doing from here with this data as well. There's a lot in here. We'll have a number of charts, graphs, tables of data. Please interrupt me with questions. I'll pause at a few points through it and ask you specifically for them, but if you have one, just interrupt me, and it'll make it much more productive for all of us. The reason we do these studies is because airlines don't see this kind of information unless it's their own tickets. So what airlines see is there's public Department of Transportation data that shows from an airport to any other airport, how many people flew that route, what airlines they were on, and what they paid. There's no data about where they live or where they're going to on their trip. So, you know, what we'll see is a number of people from Mesa County drive to Denver, and therefore they appear as Denver passengers to the airlines. And so this study helps us recategorize them as Mesa County travelers, so we get the flights here, and then Denver doesn't get the flights instead. And so, you know, we use this to help understand that true size and that true opportunity. You've had these studies done before. You had one done just before the pandemic in February of 2020. It was done with what we call traditional data, which uses travel agency data. And so it looks at tickets booked through travel agencies and the credit card associated by those tickets. And it looks at that credit card billing zip code, which is often the home residence. It's also often a corporate zip code, and we're only capturing travel agency data. The study we've done, and I'm not going to go through this in detail, but looks at search data. So it looks at people's Google search history, their Bing search history, whoever it is, and uses that to look at their intent behind the travel and specifically where they're going to and from. So not to, this gets a little bit creepy, but if I'm thinking about my trip over here today from Denver, it picked up my searches from my home computer associated to my zip code on the front range, and when I looked for flights, when I searched for a hotel, a rental car, restaurants in Grand Junction, and was able to attribute me to a particular zip code in Grand Junction as where I was going to on that trip. It knows I flew United, it knows the fare, and so we're able to see that. And so that way we understand, you know, in my case, obviously I'm using Grand Junction for Mesa County, but if I had flown into Montrose and driven up, it would see me as a Montrose passenger still coming to Mesa County.
Wow. And then you can also differentiate as business or leisure then?
We don't get a great sense of business or leisure. Okay. No, and we don't want to other than the fact I made this trip.
Gotcha.
So it is a limitation. I don't know if I'm a frequent traveler. I don't know if I make that trip often.
Gotcha.
I just know, you know, from Longmont, Colorado to Grand Junction, Colorado, that trip occurred.
Wow.
So it's very cool, but there are some limitations to it. We're focusing for most of the study on Mesa County, and we've defined this as what we call our primary catchment area. we define these zones for, if all else is equal, you have the exact same flights, schedules, pricing as every other airport around you, which airport would you still want to fly from? So for Mesa County travelers, it's pretty clear you'd want to fly from Grand Junction. If you were in Montrose, you'd want to fly from Montrose, and so on and so forth. Obviously, all else is not equal. We don't have the same flights as Denver or Salt Lake. And so that behavior varies, but we start with that definition. And what we see is Mesa County has almost 900 passengers per day each way. This is a term you've probably heard me use in some other presentations over the last year or so. We often abbreviate it as a PD. But we're basically saying in this case, over the entire time period of 2019, which is what this number is from, we had 652,000 passengers traveling to and from Mesa County. Divide by 365, divide by 2, that gets us 900. 52% of those were residents, 48% visitors, so really nicely divided there, and 81% of them were to and from the city of Grand Junction. More passengers use Grand Junction than any other individual airport, but more than 50%, a majority still go elsewhere. And I know that's a complicated sentence, but we get 47% here, Denver gets 40, so on and so forth down. Salt Lake City gets 6, the other ones are 3 or 4% each.
So Montrose would be down around the 3 or 4.
They were, yes. And just, this is 2019 data.
Right.
So we're looking at pre-pandemic, so we don't have 4 good quarters of data. Post-pandemic and seasonality is a real thing. I'll give you the spoiler alert, it doesn't look that different for people going to Montrose, even with Southwest there. There's little blips, but it's not dramatically different.
And then do we have a feel, or do you have a feel for why 40% go to Denver instead of Salt Lake? And I would assume connections or direct flights, but to me, the distance isn't much different. Sometimes you'd rather not drive to Denver.
It's cheaper to
Denver.
So Denver is often cheaper, yes. It does have more flights, it has more airlines. But I don't know why more people don't use Salt Lake, honestly. If you look at Moab, those passengers go to Salt Lake and not Denver. And it's not that different. I mean, I recognize Moab's a decent amount across the border, but you would expect people here, in Fruta or whatever, to have at least more going to Salt Lake, and they don't. And I don't know why that is. I imagine there's just some orientation, you say, in the state. People are used to going to Denver for business or, you know, whatever you're doing, and therefore you default to Denver. But I can't prove that out.
Is it by choice it's 2019 data, not 2021?
It is, yes. So it's by our choice putting this study together. When we bought the data for this, we actually bought a 12-month subscription, and we have data going back to 2016 all the way up through, we're up through third quarter of 2021 right now. And I'll show you some of those time periods. It just, 4 quarters going back from Q3 2021 does not give us a realistic view of what the market looks like. Huh. We're still in so much recovery mode that it skews it, frankly. And so it doesn't look accurate. Because we have a 12-month subscription to this data, one of the tasks from the Air Service Alliance was to come back as quarterly data was released over the course of this year and update it. And so by the time we get to the end of this year, I think we're going to have 4 really good quarters of post-pandemic data. And we can do an updated view of that data. And I'm happy to bring that to you guys, either directly or through Angela and Sarah, and bring that to you so you have that data as well. But it was a conscious decision in 2019 instead of looking at what we
had. I want to point out, too, that the view we're looking at, we haven't done before. And so it's nice to have that solid pre-pandemic baseline to work from, to look at changes too in a pandemic environment, because previous studies, they only looked at residents traveling outward, and this looks at both. So.
Well, and so to that point, you know, one area that I think of this looks so different than what we've seen before is what our top markets are. And so we've talked a lot about Los Angeles, we've talked about San Francisco, Phoenix, Dallas. I am surprised how high New York City is. And it wasn't that high in a previous study because New York, and D.C. for that matter, skew visitation. So there's more visitors than there are residents. More people from New York coming here than people from here going to New York. And so this looks like a very different opportunity than we thought it was 12 months ago. And so, you know, I'll dive into this more, but, you know, this kind of new view of how big the markets are is influencing how we look at our strategy for going out and acquiring the airspace. It is both presenting new opportunities for us that we didn't think were as big as they are, but also making us look at, you know, I'll just throw out an example, a market like Chicago that has really good connections all up and down the East Coast a little differently than we did before, knowing that we have all these connections on top of that.
Harrison, before you move from this slide, the seventh, what is that airport, WAS? Is that Washington State?
It is Washington, D.C. So
it's D.C.
Where we have an asterisk behind it, we've combined multiple airports in
gotcha.
Into one code.
So Dulles and Reagan and...
Dulles, Reagan,
okay.
Baltimore.
Gotcha.
So same thing with L.A., same thing with New York. Number eight is, we call it Bay, it's the San Francisco Bay Area. San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose.
Thank you.
The reason we do that, just broadly, I mean, obviously different airports or different airlines, different customer base, but if we're talking about, say, new service to one of these airports, we think customers would go for the nonstop service regardless of what airport it is when we offer it. And so we lump them together because it actually lets us see what the true demand is there. Rather than saying, okay, I think it's far more valuable to say we have 48 passengers per day each way to New York City, rather than, and I'm making this up, but illustratively, 20 to JFK, 20 to Newark, 8 to LaGuardia, whatever the case is, that doesn't really tell us what's going on.
Harrison, tell us a little bit about the average fare number. How was that achieved?
Yeah. So what that looks like, so this is the, we take the total amount people have paid, Mesa County travelers, to any of these destinations divided by the number of passengers to get an average. So it is truly the fare paid by those travelers over the course of the entire year, but it is regardless of the airport that they use.
It's one way.
It is a one way fare, thank you. Yes.
Okay.
It's a one-way fare. It excludes some of the taxes. So, you know, if that 157 is probably you paying 199, really, if a ticket, something like that. But
and this was $2019.
$2019, correct. Yes, not that adjusted.
You just seem a little low at the moment.
Here for average fare, that's average fare paid if they use GJT, right?
No, it is the average fare by Mason County travelers, regardless of the airport.
Yeah, so that's why it seems low.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can see, if, you know, if you're looking, you're like, oh, I've never found a, you know, I don't know, a $182 fare to Chicago, right?
Right?
Well, when you look, we're only retaining 22% of that traffic. And so presumably, you know, that's part of why they're leaking, is they can get that low fare somewhere else.
So that,
and I'll show you that breakdown in a couple slides.
So essentially, when you think of the slide before with 47% originating from GJT and 40 from Denver,
yep.
That blended rate shows up here.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Yep.
That's exactly what it is. So just to drive the point home, because I really found this kind of mind-blowing to me, we've been talking a lot about growth to the west. We certainly talked about it with Delta and Salt Lake City. West is only 30% of where our travelers are going. And this is stunning to me. And 70% are to the east. And then you can look at the bullet point below each of those. When people fly to the west, they use Grand Junction at a very high rate. 70% of them fly to Grand Junction. When they go to the east, only 36% do. And the rest are at Denver. And so I don't know if that's, you know, a mentality of you're driving already east to go fly to the east, and it's somehow easier to do that than it is to, you know, because people don't think of Salt Lake City for whatever reason, they don't want to drive east to fly west. I don't quite know what's going on with that. The fares don't look that different when you think about kind of the distance adjustment. So I don't quite know how to process that out other than it's a really interesting trend for us, and it's an opportunity. Because it means we're not meeting the needs of travelers to the east. And so it means, you know, one of the recommendations we have coming out of this is reprioritize the way we look at some of our air service targets. You know, where some of these markets we thought of maybe as a longer-term opportunity, we're actually accelerating our discussions with airlines and bringing them in the forefront earlier than we thought it was, you know, practical before.
I could see those numbers change now since Delta's pulled out of the westerly connection to SkyWest. I would suspect that. So it's going to reflect the change.
I think you're probably right about that. Yes.
And you can't parse out in these numbers which ones are direct flights and which ones are...
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Three slides.
Okay. Because I'm like, I think I, you know, tell you why.
You can see what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get there.
You did well in math, didn't you?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Benton.
Especially for an English major.
We see United as the largest airline for basic county travelers, but if you notice this graph here, we have how much of that is each airport, and that's because they're Denver. At Grand Junction, American's the largest carrier for travelers to and from Mesa County. This is not surprising. We know this from the stats you see every month. What's different here is you see the Denver view of it. What also should stand out to you here, at least stand out to me, is that Southwest is your fourth largest carrier. And obviously Southwest isn't here. But they're roughly the same size in the market as Delta is. And this is 2019. This is before they're at Montrose. This is before they're at Colorado Springs or Hayden. This is just Denver. And so passengers are still driving there at a really high rate, 126 a day, each way, to fly Southwest.
Wow.
One of the theories I always think about when we look at this is, okay, is it visitors who don't know? Is it residents? And we do see a little bit of a gap there. Residents are more likely to use a local airport than visitors are. That shouldn't be too surprising. But they use Denver basically the same rate. What's different is some of the visitors use Montrose, Eagle, some of those mountain airports a little bit differently. We can't prove it in our data. My theory is these are passengers on multi-stop trips across Colorado that may fly into another airport, say fly into Montrose, go to the Black Canyon or Gunnison Park, come up here, go to the Colorado National Monument. Our data is going to attribute them to a single destination. And so whatever it deems as their primary destination is what it's going to attribute them to. It's probably imperfect in some of these cases. You guys may have another theory, but that's the best thing I've come up with as to why we're seeing some of the mountain airports pop there. But clearly our visitors are not using Grand Junction at the same rate as residents are.
How well do you feel you're capturing Southwest, since they're not participating in travel agencies and have their own website? Do you feel you're capturing all of those?
So I think this data is better at capturing them than any other data out there. I don't think it's perfect. I think all of this we should, you know, think of as highly accurate but not perfect. Mm-hmm. In any sense.
Like, yeah.
This data is tied back to that DOT data I mentioned at the beginning that just looks airport to airport. And so every one of those trips is allocated out, and that is highly accurate by law. The airlines have to report it. So I feel really good about that data. Are you going to miss a zip code here or there on the allocation? Yeah, probably. But I think it's more accurate than anything else out there now. Absolutely. Yeah.
So Harrison, as you look at the visitor numbers here to Montrose and Eagle, and being a Google search, if the visitor lands in Eagle, at some point in time they ended up in Mesa County.
Yes.
But it's possible that they also spent time in Glenwood Springs, maybe throughout the state.
Yeah.
But they chose to land at those airports at the start of their trip.
Start of or end of.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and so you know, we do identify some of those, the total open drop trips, you fly in the Eagle out of Grand Junction or whatever the case is, those get identified poorly. They're a very tiny percent of the overall data.
Okay.
But there will be some others around.
Can you tell how many of those folks had a mountain bike in their baggage?
Definitely want to know that. Who liked wine?
I
was here for the peaches. No
I also can't directly answer your question, Lindy, on the nonstop connections.
Yeah.
But we pulled this out to look at those routes where nonstop flights exist versus connecting flights. I can't prove that these customers flew nonstop. But it's a reasonable inference. Where a nonstop flight exists, we retain 83.6% of travelers. Where there's a connecting flight only, we retain 37%. That's a massive gap.
Yeah.
That is a bigger gap than we've seen with most of our clients. This is stunning to me, actually. And what this is stunning in a good way in the fact that you guys, where you have nonstop flights, the community supports you. The community uses them. And that's phenomenal because it means as we add more service, we expect to see similar results. And what stands out to me especially here is the Dallas-Fort Worth line. you have, obviously, nonstop flights on American. You keep 63% of the passengers. But look at that fare difference between Grand Junction and Denver. It's $144 more one way on average to fly to Dallas out of Grand Junction. And you still keep 63% of the passengers, which tells me passengers are valuing that nonstop flight more than they are valuing a lower fare. Mm-hmm. Now, would that usage be higher if that fare gap was less? Yeah, absolutely. Would we rather see lower fares? Absolutely. But I can still go show this to an airline of, look at the community response. They are willing to pay more to use this airport where you provide good service. That's a really good position for us to be in, to go talk to an airline. There's a lot of airports that don't have this kind of significant gap because their customers are trained to always go to another airport, no matter what the case is. They don't believe their local airport meets their needs, so they never look at it. That's not the case here.
I would love to see numbers one state become available for Q3 and 4, 2021. Should I just say post-Southwest in Montrose? Because I think that whole dynamic chart would change quite a bit.
So, can I show you that on the next slide?
Yes.
I think it does.
That was planned.
Well done, Mike.
So this is not perfectly what you're asking me for, but back to 2016, bars are passenger volume. The line here is the percentage of people using Grand Junction. So obviously in the pandemic, passenger volume fell off a cliff. We know that. But the people who were traveling used the local airport dramatically at a dramatically higher rate than they did pre-pandemic. Now, gets back to how much I believe this data. I think 90% is probably a little bit of a stretch here. But there's a huge gap there. We're not off by 40 points, which is what that difference is. And that Q1 dip you see there in the data, where our usage went down, that is Southwest and Montrose. That is where more people went down because that's when they had the ski season schedule up, of operating those 3 to 4 flights a day. The rest of the time they're at one flight a day, give or take. And we actually don't see it that impactful. We see the travelers who are flying are using this airport at a higher rate than they ever have before, which is phenomenal. This is also the time period where the airport and the Air Service Alliance were out there screaming about the flights and marketing about them in a way we haven't done before. Hmm. And so can we attribute that perfectly back to this data? Absolutely not. But I see a correlation at minimum. This is the time when we're out there telling people what they have.
Should we expect another Q1 dip just because of that same reasoning?
That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And particularly because it's going to correspond with the Delta exit.
Yeah.
We're not going to, we won't get Q1 data for 6-ish months. Yeah. So it's going to be quite a while until we know that. But that would be my theory. Yes.
Well, and I think it's important to note, too, if you look, a Q1 dip for us is not new. Like, that's a consistent trend, because that's when the surrounding airports have most of their air service, right, is in that Q1 period. And so for passenger, and it's when we typically have the least amount of service. So, you know, it makes sense that that's when they'd be substituting away. And again, if you value convenience and nonstop flights, you know, if nearby you have nonstop flights that are affordable in the winter, you know, it makes sense that people would be skipping that connection. Where possible. And so I think, you know, the trend is deeper here in Q1 2021, presumably because of Southwest. Also, you know, we had a lot less service in Q1 2021 than we had, you know, the summer before even. And you know, a year ago, things really, you know, we were in a pandemic state very much so in the first quarter of 2021 yet again. So I think all of that, you know, it makes sense. And what we find most encouraging is that it came back, right? You look, it didn't stay that low. And that's where I think nationally, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit, Harrison, to the trends you're seeing. I mean, smaller airports that have retained air service and grown air service, because secondary airports in Colorado are an exception to the trends we've seen nationally. Secondary airports in Colorado have really grown in the pandemic. That is not true on average at secondary airports nationwide. You know, they're losing a lot of air service. So I don't know if you want to speak to kind of what that pandemic trend looked like at other airports.
So I don't have that exact data to kind of do the apples to apples. I will show you other Colorado airports towards the end on the same kind of graph. But what we saw in other airports early in the pandemic, in area metro areas with multiple airports, there was a definite shift towards a secondary airport. So in San Francisco Bay Area, there was a shift away from San Francisco towards Oakland, for example. And that, you know, certainly we looked at some of the capacity, but at the time there were so few passengers flying. It was more passenger choice than it was capacity driven. That was not sustainable throughout the pandemic. People went back to primary airports. We're not seeing that in Colorado yet. We're seeing people still favor their local airports. Last kind of specific to Mesa County view and talking about some of the changes here, we did see the top markets change coming out of the pandemic away from 2019. My belief right now is this is temporary. And this is driven by the fact that the coasts have been very slow to reopen, particularly New York and California, which have driven some of our largest markets. Mm-hmm. Every one of those markets is also smaller in the four quarters ending Q3 2021 than it was in 2019. We're still not rebuilt. So I'm not reading a ton into this right now. It is the case that top markets are all where we have nonstop service. Top markets are also where we've added some service, like Los Angeles, like Denver, which is certainly going to drive some of that. I don't believe at this point that we can say this is the last big change. But I don't know, and so this is one that we're absolutely tracking over the next 12 months to understand this, because this does have big implications for our strategy and what we're going to have.
What's your sense of why Miami and Seattle jumped into the top 10?
So Miami actually popped up in a lot of the ski markets as a top market, particularly Aspen, particularly in the Vail area. And so I think at some point there were some limited connections into some of those airports, and so people looked a little further. It's relatively small. Seattle has been growing for a very long time in our market. You don't see it in the top 10, but it's not far off the top 10 in 2019. And so I think the trend just accelerated a little bit throughout the pandemic. What's really interesting in Seattle is there's a lot of visitation to Moab. There's a lot of visitation to the mountains from Seattle. That's not in this number, but it certainly presents a different opportunity coming out of the pandemic than it did during. Any other questions before we zoom out for a little bit? Okay. If you think I'm still, please interrupt me. The other seven areas we looked at, so starting up in the mountains, we looked at the ski resort areas broadly of Vail and Summit County, over 4,000 passengers per day each way. This is a year-round average. I'll show you the seasonality for a couple of these. But basically counting everything from Beaver Creek up to the tunnels along I-70, Breckenridge, Copper, Keystone, all those. Aspen Snowmass, 1,500 people. Glenwood Carbondale, it looks like it kind of wraps around Aspen on the map, but that's really just because of the way the zip code boundaries work. All of our data is on the zip code level, so there's some weird mapping things. This is, practically speaking, Glenwood Carbondale assault. We have the Parachute Newcastle zone that includes Wrangell and Silt. Again, the zip code going up towards Wrangley and Meeker is just the way the zip codes are drawn. We didn't intentionally pull that in. That's just where we are. Mesa County, obviously, what we just finished talking about. Montrose, Delta, Ure, and Telluride down at the bottom there. And then, at least to my colorblind eyes, it's kind of hard to see, but Moab is in a fine zone as well on the other side of the border. For each of these, I'm going to show you an overwhelming number slide here to kind of talk through the opportunity we see. We look broadly at what those top markets are, the airlines that they use, fares they're paying, and kind of use that to gauge the opportunity. The airport will get all of this. You are all more than welcome to have the full details or 50-page narrative if you'd like to, and or the slide presentation of what this looks like. But starting here, we just wanted to look at what airports are these passengers using? And the red box is where we see opportunity at a high level. And then we'll dive into that more detail. So using Aspen as our example here, 61% of passengers to and from the Aspen Snowmass area are still driving to Denver. 34% use Aspen. there's no reason those 61% of passengers, a good portion of those shouldn't be coming here instead of Edinburgh. We're more convenient, we're more reliable, every superlative we've said for a long time about the airport. That's the opportunity there, the 34% using Aspen, we're not gonna, you know, convince them to drive 2 hours instead of 10 minutes. You kind of go down this list, Glenwood has a big opportunity. Montrose probably less of an opportunity, but a good number of people are still driving to Denver, which means they're driving right by your front door, which certainly doesn't make a lot of logical sense. Moab, this is that, you know, cross the border and everyone seems to go to Salt Lake instead of Denver. Those 58% of passengers going to Salt Lake is a really good opportunity for us to take them back, especially since we are the number two airport for Moab. We carry more passengers to and from Moab than Canyonlands Airport right outside Moab does. So we're already well positioned there and we think there's an opportunity to grow. Telluride, probably less so. Parachute, Newcastle, Rifle, Silt area. There's no reason 3/4 of passengers should be driving to Denver versus staying here.
No.
So,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Do these include both the residents and visitors?
They do.
Okay.
Yes.
So maybe that speaks to Moab's Salt Lake City.
I think it
and
is.
Being a large degree of visitors.
It's certainly mostly visitors. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. I have it in a few slides. They're 92% visitors.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think it makes logical sense you're going to Utah. But I think it's, you know, where we can provide a compelling option.
Right.
And, you know, again, back to this is designed for the Air Service Alliance for how they deploy their funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they see an opportunity to attract new visitors coming in here instead of using a competing airport, and that helps support air service growth, that's absolutely an opportunity that they're considering.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I can't speak for how they interpret it, but that's how I'm setting it up. So I've got one slide on each of these zones here, just to dive us in, and we can answer any questions about these as we go. Bayonet Summit County is probably one of the, I'd say, less likely opportunities. It's massive. 4,000 passengers per day, overwhelmingly visitors, overwhelmingly using Denver. They use Denver over Eagle because Denver is substantially cheaper, to the tune of $200 each way. When they come to Grand Junction today, they're coming because they're using Allegiant. And they're going to Phoenix, they're going to Las Vegas. And so we've kind of had the idea for a while that we can actually be that ultra low cost carrier base for Western and Central Colorado. These are really tiny numbers of people coming today, but it actually kind of proves the theory that as we grow that service, we'll attract from a broader region. Our fares to Phoenix and Vegas are cheaper than Denver, if you remember back, I had both slides. And so we're proving we can actually bring some of those travelers in. Are we going to be able to do so in a number of markets or to a huge extent? Probably not. But there's also probably some limited opportunity here for regions, particularly to the west, where you're driving west to fly west, where Eagle does not have a nonstop flight and we do. As we grow, that we might be able to pick up some more travelers. Aspen, on the surface, looks like much of the same opportunity, but I actually view this very differently. For one, we have more passengers using Grand Junction today. I know it still shows up as zero, but it is a higher number. The fares at Aspen are ridiculous. And Aspen's limited on growth. Even if they wanted to, they can't accept bigger airplanes than they have today.
Mm.
And so that means not only are they limited in passengers per flight, they're limited to the three mainline airplanes that offer CRJ-700 aircraft. So you can't have anyone other than Delta, American, United serving Aspen. Any other airline that wants to has to look for your airport. And I think we're uniquely positioned to be that other airport in a lot of cases.
Yes. When we say visitors, do we mean primary residents, second home, third home, fifth home? What do we mean there?
We mean, it's a complicated answer, but basically, where Google thinks your primary home is. So effectively where your primary device lives.
That to me would throw that number off in both Aspen, Vail,
yes.
Any of those, because most likely they have a home in a lot of cases in that area. So they would be making situations. So I'm just trying to connect that with Glenwood and some of these other ones. But.
Yeah. No, that will throw off a little bit, for sure.
Perhaps a little different between Aspen and Vail because there's so much lodging available in the Vail area compared to Aspen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, when we look at this opportunity, we see Aspen as very limited in what they can offer, even if they wanted to, and we're not. And so that presents an opportunity. There's a lot of airlines that don't have this airplane to come in and may want to be able to serve the market. And so, I mean, look at what Southwest is doing in Montrose in order to serve Telluride. They're not serving Montrose because of Montrose. We think there's a compelling reason for a lot of airlines to serve Grand Junction because of Grand Junction, but maybe there's a plus Aspen at the end of that discussion.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. We're missing Aspen people that may have homes in Aspen, but they're still using Denver instead of coming to Junction.
Exactly.
So they're not necessarily people that don't understand where we are.
Yes.
They just are using Denver for something.
Well, that's $200 less one way. And a lot more on Southwest.
Yeah. My only argument would be is a lot of these folks are not as concerned about cost.
Fair.
They want convenience.
Right. So we have no traffic. Yes.
I would
we have education to do.
I can't put it all together.
We've got education to do.
There's definitely education to do. And, you know, and when we talk about most reliable, going through a canyon, that is occasionally been closed in the last year.
Yeah.
We shut that a shorter down. Drive time. Now, we're not arguing to shut I-70 down.
Oh, okay.
But we are arguing for people to take a shorter drive on I-70 and an easier drive on I-70. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Even if it's open.
No matter what the status is of the rest of the road is.
Well, I mean,
we still think we're better.
Really has changed. I mean, if there were a lot of days you don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't they have 100,000 pound max weight in Aspen?
You would know better than I
do. I think it's 100,000, which would bring in the ERJ 145s, 175s as well.
There's a wingtip restriction that takes out the 175s.
Yeah. And probably. Erling, it's got to be the single.
That's probably true. Weight wise, you're right. I didn't think about the wingspan.
Yeah.
They have a pretty crazy bottom standard for the ramp because they're limited on space.
Right.
I would think it's as much the single engine mist performance back out of there as well.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. And you end up on chair 7 if you don't like it.
Right. Anyway.
Are you going to want to talk about runway performance? So Glenwood Carbondale, I think this is one where there's substantially more residents, true residents, in the area than there are anywhere else. So we're looking at 38% residents, 62% residents. Mm. It is far easier to go out and talk to residents and make them aware of the opportunity. We still see relatively low usage when they come to us. They still tend to fly Allegiant. There's an opportunity here to grow that usage. There's an opportunity here for a lot of those markets that we looked at, the top markets that have 20, 30 people out of the Glenwood Springs area. And so if we're able to pick up a reasonable portion of those, that makes our market size look quite a bit bigger to be able to go attract that service. These three markets together behave nearly identically from a seasonality perspective. So chart on the left is a trend line of their seasonality as an index of total 2019 demand. So what you're seeing there is you're seeing each quarter look different than the average. You're also seeing the growth over the last 5 years built in that. And so what should stand out? Third quarter pops. There's more people coming in the summer than there are in the winter. Hmm. Or probably more accurately, there are more people flying into the area in the summer than the winter. Winter is certainly busier than second and fourth quarter. Chart on the right shows you, though, top line there is the people to these regions flying to and from Denver. And then the bottom line is not Denver, any other airport in the area. Hmm. And so when people come to ski, yes, it's less overall volume, but they're far more likely to use the local airport. Which is just this kind of an interesting way to think through this, of the opportunity that, you know, people are looking for more convenience, particularly in the winter. They're willing to pay more to come into some of those secondary airports. There's a different mindset around ski traffic than there is around somewhere.
Do we have...
trying to make clear.
Does that correlate to the amount of time they have to spend? Like, we're doing a four-day weekend, and we want to spend 2.5 of those days on mountain. Whereas in the summer, they're going to just take the week or whatever. Like,
there's no real way to prove that, but I mean, I think that's, I would think that as well. I think that's a really reasonable theory to think about it. I also think at some point, they're also already paying for lift tickets and everything else, and you're willing to pay more to bypass this.
Who's going to do it all?
At some point, why not?
Yeah.
And the schedules are much richer in the winter. So that convenience factor is there too, whereas, you know, the convenience factor is not there so much in the summer. Mm. You know, for example, American is not even flying the Phoenix route from Aspen or Montrose this summer. You know, we're the only airport on, in Western Colorado that they're flying to Phoenix.
Gotcha.
So the options are far more limited. I mean, their average daily flights are two or three times in the winter what they are. Actually, more than that, typically.
All right, I've gone through three of these zones. I have four more. I'm going to do a little faster for these other ones. Mostly because I think the opportunity is what we've talked through. Montrose, 300 passengers per day. Most of them use Montrose today. A decent number come up here. Again, primarily for those Allegiant routes. I think it's fascinating that of the people in or going to Montrose, 74% of them drive up here to go to Las Vegas, where we have not some things. Is there an opportunity to do more and more of that as we get more nonstops? Sure. Is it going to really move the needle? Probably not so much, particularly on the Southwest market. And really, I think the same story for Telluride. It is a smaller market, pre-pandemic, most use Montrose. Some still came up here. So we certainly don't want to discount it, particularly if we're able to get some of those really unique markets that the community can support, because we are a real city. But this is probably not our target going forward, absent a few really strategic opportunities. In contrast, Moab is a target, I think. Big market, growing market, grew throughout the pandemic, 300 passengers a day, they all go to Salt Lake City. We compete far better with Salt Lake City than we do with Denver, because our fares are more competitive. Salt Lake City, on average, has higher fares than Denver. They have, you know, fewer flight options, but still a big hub with Delta. But they don't have that kind of three-airline hub dynamic you have in Denver. And so the fare gap looks a lot more competitive here. And so if you're able to convince more passengers, you've already got 15% of them coming here, but more of them to make that shorter drive, you don't have to get over the same fare hurdle. I think there's a really good opportunity here, particularly as we're able to grow flights to both coasts. Moab tends to attract a lot of West Coast, but also a decent amount of East Coast flyers. And so there's an opportunity here to help us boost some of those market sizes when we're out talking to airlines. We've already started incorporating this in to some of the airline discussions, and they've certainly responded positively to it. I think particularly Moab and Aspen, because their names everyone knows. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty powerful to use them. Mm-hmm. Less powerful from a name perspective, but I think actually really critical for the way we grow our local market is looking at this zone from Parachute to Newcastle.
It's crazy. 76%.
It's crazy.
It is stunning how many people drive to Denver. I don't really know how to understand that other than, yes, it's low fares, but at 3 hours driving extra.
So,
and parking.
Yeah, it begs the question, what's the barrier to entry? Is it a preconceived, like, my understanding is that marketing has changed completely in the last, I don't know, 3-5 years. Nobody uses billboards anymore. They're the worst way to spend money. But same thing with print, so on and so forth. Like, it's all about placement and monitoring what people search for online. And so I'm just wondering, like, is the barrier to entry just strictly cost, and we're not going to change people's mind about that? Or is there an education component we can attack? Like, how do we start to discover that?
So I think there's absolutely an education component there, no doubt. And I'm not a marketing expert, so I don't know what's the right avenue to do. But, you know, we, the airport, and the Air Service Alliance went out and were talking to this community last summer about new service offerings, new flights, why you should be using Red Junction. I think we should be looking at doing that exact same thing in this zone, too. Because I don't think people are aware. So this, I think for a long time there was training. This is a higher fare, lower option airport.
Yeah.
This is still 2019 data.
It is 2019.
Yes. So we don't know if they're businesses or residents, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Because my guess would be oil and gas, and folks are flying in and out of there, back to where they got to go, and they go through Denver. I would be surprised how many residents driving to Denver instead of going to. But I would think there'd be some business that we're not, we don't know.
We don't know who's business or leisure. We do know, you know, based on that kind of home location of your device, 80% of this is resident traffic, not inbound visitation.
So I guess the next thing when you think about the multiplier effect, the Erling multiplier effect, when Erling's family goes, there's four of them. So when we look at the 135 per day, can we tell how many of those are families? How many people, when they book that flight, they book four tickets or five tickets?
We can't
dig in a little bit further, because that multiplier makes a difference. If you're saving $100 times four, that's $400, you're going to drive.
Yeah, I think we have that hypothesis, and we feel confident that, you know, there's correlation between leakage and group size. Yeah. Because of exactly what you're talking about, but unfortunately there's just not data to measure that at this point in time.
So maybe I missed something. So we do know that 80% of this data is personal, not business.
We know 80% of this zone is people who live in the parachute and cast area.
Who Google thinks live in the parachute area.
Their primary computer is there.
But to your point, I mean, oil and gas, you have an extended work assignment.
There's probably some of that mixed in. I don't think it'll be all of it, though.
Although you think, too, if their company is flying them back and forth, they would go to the closest airport. Halliburton is going to pay for your ticket.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, like, in 2019, we still had, you know, just trucks, oil and gas trucks. Like, you always know when shifts are changing because there's just so many trucks here to drop guys off and then pick them up. I mean, the airport, you always know when there's major shift changes.
I would think the reservation systems could track the number of tickets booked when they go through.
Well, the reservation ticket systems can. The
airlines don't share any information they don't have to share, for obvious reasons, you know.
Yeah. The Google Analytics is not.
And that's exactly why DOT requires they submit, you know, the information we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then the Google component, the search engine component, gets... You know, it really makes it come to life.
It's almost not big enough to worry about, but you wonder why you're missing.
Yeah.
Because if you can't get them here, how are you going to get Glenwood Carpenter?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's good to look at those examples, right, to say, how would we achieve this?
Where's the remaining 10%?
I would imagine there's some Aspen and some people I don't know.
Okay. So others?
Other airports out here, yeah. I kind of only bothered to call out the ones we were most focused on.
And then I would just be curious about the land, the mudslides, and how that shifted all that traffic away, you know.
Yeah, and we'll get, could you have through second quarter?
I heard you have quarter.
Third?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll look at it.
That'd be interesting to know, yeah.
We want the data.
That's the thing with data, is you want more. You know, it's...
Yeah, you get addicted to it.
But it's how you become
but it's
fully,
helpful.
Like, very informed, you know, yes. With real information.
Yeah.
So, kind of tying this out towards the end here, as we look at COVID recovery, I just want to look at how each of these zones have recovered, because they look very different here. Telluride is at the top, has grown dramatically. This is Southwest Country Park, clearly. Montrose is kind of tied up in that noise with everybody else, but they're near the top of that. Parachute Newcastle is up at the top of that too, though. And so, you know, some of that is undoubtedly just the growth of the region, new residents, new home building. Aspen is our laggard right now, and kind of hard to understand why they haven't grown back at the same rate, honestly.
Well, I think some of it might be what Clay is talked about, right? I mean, when you have, you know, the surge in second home ownership and you're having dwell times massively increase, and all of a sudden you're not living in your Manhattan apartment, you're living in Aspen, you know, your number of trips back and forth is likely smaller. So, I mean, I think we have some guesses, but we don't, it's not an area we're focused on, because that's not where we think there's opportunity.
And I would just think that the COVID protocols were more in alignment with New York and California and Aspen than they were with most of Western Colorado, and that probably has to play into some of that too.
Mm.
With the increased charter and corporate, but mostly charter flights in and out of Aspen that we've seen peaking here, I think they can afford to charter an airplane in Aspen.
Yeah,
so instead of hopping on a commercial, I think that has at least some form of a player.
And that's completely invisible
to me. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's smart, Erling, because in other markets we look and we're like, oh, they're substituting away from flying to driving. But I think up there, you're probably right. They're substituting away from flying commercially to flying
more private jet.
They're going so 24/7 with max capacity in there with charters. It's incredible.
Wow. Well, and so one way we actually can see that substitution, not to private, but in the airport they use, this is that same kind of chart over time showing who's using their home, their local airports. So each of these lines is one of those catchment areas that has their own airport. And so you see both Montrose and Grand Junction, PCAP, you already saw the Mason County line before. But Aspen did the same thing. And so we know that there's a $200 fare gap. So maybe there is some of that substitution of the people who were driving to Denver are now flying in Aspen. What's interesting though is we actually don't see it in either Moab or Vail. There's no appreciable change in that. And so, you know, from the Mesa County standpoint, this is great, we're on trend, that our passengers are also taking advantage of what's offered in their local community. Trading up slightly, certainly not to the extent they are in Aspen or Montrose. But when you're looking at some of these other areas, it still suggests there's a massive opportunity in Moab, in Vail, lesser extent for us, but where people are still not using their local airport, where, you know, as you can establish yourself as a strong alternative, you can do really well in the market.
Yeah.
And so just tying this up here, the recommendations that we've made as part of this report to both the airport and the Air Service Alliance, you've heard these throughout everything I said, otherwise I'd really fail to talk you through this, is re-examine our priorities and bring this new data in. This is not to say we shouldn't be focused on the Los Angeles and San Francisco's and other markets that we had been working on for quite a while, but it does mean we probably should reprioritize Chicago's of the world and think about that a little bit differently. So instead of that's the second discussion point for an airline, we're bringing it up to be number one when we need them and reprioritizing. It does mean looking at attracting customers beyond Mason County and putting a new focus on that. And this is more for the Air Service Alliance, who can go out and deploy their money to do that more than the airport, who's more limited in their ability. But how can we be pulling some of those passengers in from along I-70 parachute to Glenwood, but also into Aspen, into Moab? How can we be establishing ourselves as a better alternative for those travelers? And last, and certainly not least, is that usage that we saw of Mesa County travelers using GJT that skyrocketed, how can we keep it really high? Because that is a phenomenal place to be right now. Inevitably, that's going to drop down a little bit coming out of a pandemic, especially as services gone down here. But how do we keep it as high as possible for the longest possible time? What we're doing from here as our next steps, so we've already been incorporating this into the discussions and meetings we've had with clients. You authorized us to start this work early December. We had a meeting with an airline the next week and we brought some of this in. We had airline meetings 2 weeks ago in San Antonio as part of one of those Air Service Development Conferences. We really focused our discussions around a lot of this data, where it made sense to, obviously, but bringing this in to help build our case of why these make sense. We have started the discussions around, but really haven't kind of finalized how we reprioritize and how we adjust our targets going forward. But that's absolutely a big part of this. And then we will be coming to the Air Service Alliance, and as you would like to see us, back to you with updates throughout the end of the year as we have more and more of this data. And that certainly informs our strategy going forward and adjusts it going forward. This is not intended to be a one and done, nor is this intended to be this is the only way you consume this data. As you have questions, please ask them. We'll be more than happy to look into things as well. That's what I've got. I know that's a lot. Are there other questions that we haven't covered so far?
Do you have a bet on business travel?
Do I have a bet on business travel?
Or projection? Because in my mind, we're not catching that in anything 21.
Yeah.
And I think things have changed a lot since 19.
Yes. I think things have changed a lot. I actually think if you look back at, let me go back a few slides, a lot of slides here. When we had kind of that really low period in 2020 and almost no one was flying, I think that was largely the people who had to be traveling or felt a strong need to, and they were using the local airport. Is that large corporate travelers? No. visit small business travelers? I think absolutely. And I actually think that's where, you know, Mesa County in particular is really strong. This isn't the Microsofts and the Amazons of the world who are traveling and, you know, have travel bans in place. These are relatively small businesses who had to in order to keep the business running. I think that's a real strength right now in business travel, honestly. Because I think we're not seeing the corporate accounts come back the same way the smaller accounts are. I think that can't stay that way, honestly. The corporate's going to come back. Is it going to be less than it was pre-pandemic? Yes. But there are some things you can't do over Zoom. I can come do a 5-slide update for you over Zoom and be in front of you more often throughout the year. But to do one of these in-depth studies to actually talk through and have a good discussion, it still requires me to be here. And I think that's what we're seeing.
I think that's a good summary, Harrison. The 1,000-plus employee company has figured out how to do, or mandated,
yeah,
Zoom meetings. Those 5 to 50 employees, you know, they're still traveling to go see their customer in some cases.
Well, I've had a lot of those big companies where it was intra-company travel. It was, I'm going to go meet with other people in the company, and that's why I'm traveling. And that's not as important.
Mm. Can you go back to the very first slide that kind of showed the major airports that are...
I know.
Yeah, the top markets. Is there a way to overlay some of this data with what Visit Grand Junction gathers for visitors that are coming here by vehicle?
That's interesting.
Good leading question. So we're sitting down with Visit Grand Junction immediately following your service on ICD on Friday.
Okay.
I don't know what is possible at this point.
Yeah.
But we're planning to, they'll see this as part of the air service lines, but absolutely debrief with them more detail on how we can combine this data together.
It'll be interesting to see, because I think they do have some demographics of who's coming here, right? And maybe only 10% of them come here by air, or whatever that number looks like.
Well, and what we're hoping for is when we look at, okay, we haven't really focused on New York historically, and I'm just using that as a hypothetical example. What data does Visit Grand Junction have that helps us make that case? Because we've done that with them for Los Angeles. We've done that with them for, say, Phoenix or Dallas or whatever the case is. We now need to look at some of those other markets with them as well, as we do that reorganization exercise.
Well, thank you for making that connection as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Angela, for making that happen.
Yeah. All right. Anything else for Harrison?
This is very informative.
Yeah. Good study. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if you do come over quarterly or whenever it is, we'd happy to buy you dinner for another update.
Yeah. I don't know that I'll be here quarterly, but I will. Maybe on a screen.
That'd be fun.
But tomorrow he is going to go explore the monument, which, you know, I think is pretty exciting. Yep. We sell Grand Junction, at least in part, for a living, so it's important that you've been to the places you talk about.
We'll make you a list of all of our favorite spots.
I would love to have it. I feel like I keep selling this market, and there's the thing. We've done some of it, but not enough of it.
Yeah. Thank you. This is really empowering, I think, as we think about how we talk about the airport too and how we support you as you go out and strategize. And so thank you.
Thanks again, Harrison. Might want to share your hobbies with Angela, and we'll line up, you know, some of these guys that know the choice spots for what those hobbies look like. So. All right. Very good. Appreciate that. Next item on our agenda is discussing our draft 2022 airport goals.
Sure, and this, I will say too, this was not planned to be this way, but I think it's the perfect combination, right? So we're talking very big picture already, and so getting to zoom in closer to this year, and you'll see that, you know, we've talked about this, as an airport, we really have to look more on like an 18-month horizon. There's some things where we can define within the bounds of this year, but other things where we need to look on a couple-year horizon. So, sorry, this is a lot of words on the screen, but it's what our leadership team has fleshed out to be, you know, the goals that we'd like to put before you for consideration at an airport level for this next year. So, you know, our number one, these are in prioritized order, I will say, when it comes to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's largely driven by the need and the urgency and the problems we're trying to solve. So our first goal is to really put air service back on a growth trajectory at the airport. Harrison mentioned that we, and you guys knew that we were in San Antonio meeting with airlines. Those conversations went relatively well, but the relative part is important. I mean, it is a hard time to be trying to attract new regional service, given the pilot shortages. So we want to get back on a growth trajectory. Given Delta's departure, you know, that's not the path we're on at this present moment, right? You know, we're in recovery mode. And, you know, we've talked about this a little bit, but I just want to reiterate, we were prepared to deal with this. We just expected to deal with it earlier in the pandemic than now. I think we were feeling out of the... actually, as an industry, I think we were feeling pretty confident we were coming out of things, and then all of a sudden, we had a new problem to solve, and an urgent one. So we want to put ourselves back on a growth trajectory, and so, you know, we've outlined here a few ways to do that. We say growth, we are primarily focused on passenger service, but when you look at 1A, executing a new airline use and lease agreement, that one's important for cargo growth as well. So as we have conversations with FedEx in particular, by far our largest cargo carrier, you know, they want to see a stable airline use and lease agreement where they're, you know, we're not in month-to-month holdover before they're going to grow in our market. So we think the timing is right in discussions with different group in the airlines, the airport affairs and corporate real estate team, that they're open and willing and frankly eager to get leases in place. I mean, we're both vulnerable in a month-to-month holdover situation. That's the situation we're in. To remind commissioners, we've been in holdover since 2009. So that is a really important goal, and that's important. That actually is really important for number one and number two, those goals, because it's not sustainable for us to have airline use and lease agreements that are in that holdover state. And, you know, should we want to do things like go and borrow more money, things like that, it would really handicap us, you know, when it comes to even just credit ratings and outlooks. It's hard to be overly optimistic about Grand Junction when your use and lease agreements, you know, have 1 month left on them. So that's important. And that one we feel confident needs to happen. Number two, you know, we want to see service to two new target destinations by 2023. It is a really weird time right now. Again, and those airlines are not flying routes that are proven and profitable, right? To the extent they were before, and that's true in our market. So when it comes to this summer, you know, we anticipate that United's going to continue to fly 5 times a day. Well, that brings us back to that pre-pandemic level, but that's not what that's less than they flew last summer. And we're seeing that with most airlines. And so growth is a really dirty word within airlines right now, because, you know, if, and it makes sense, right? If you're in charge, you're senior management in an airline, the last thing you want is your team coming to you wanting to grow and try new stuff. It's like, no, get back to making money on the routes you know make money, then we can talk about growth. So it makes it just a steeper challenge than it's been. But we think that this goal is realistic if we put it on a 2-year horizon. That doesn't mean that we're not working hard trying to add service as soon as possible. But just based on feedback we've received from our airline partners, we might not see that growth this year. So I want to be realistic with the board. When it comes to service announcements, you know, pre-pandemic, if we had new service that would be starting in the spring or summer, you'd see those announcements by November, December. And so we phrased it this way because we think this represents reality when it comes to those new destinations. And we've said target destinations specifically, you know, historically and frankly, until we had all this information, we would have said at least one of them needs to be westbound, hub connectivity. And we still think that's really important when it comes to the Delta service that we've lost, and that nonstop service to Salt Lake City is important as well. But we have other important destinations that are severely underserved that represent a lot of leakage in our market, like Harrison just covered. And so ultimately, we, in partnership with the airlines, want to work with them to grow in a way that makes sense with their airline strategy. And we think there's opportunity in both directions. So we want to exceed our budgeted 2022 employments. When we put that budget out there, we said that it was a conservative budget. With Delta's departure, that is a real goal, hitting that budget. Well, with Delta's departure and the reason for Delta's departure being the pilot shortage, it's a real, we're gonna have to work to meet that target. But most of our revenue numbers spin off from that enplanement number, right? I mean, it's the parking revenue and, you know, the rental car revenue and the concession revenue that really, it's all tied back to those enplanements. And so our target is, you know, we want to exceed that budget, and that's what we're working towards. We want those airplanes to be full. And next, you know, we want to better promote the GJT airline ticket purchases. What that means is right now, with our ultra low cost carrier partners in particular, it's really a challenge. Like if we talk about the parachute Newcastle opportunity, right? We know a lot of people live there who drive up to the resorts to work, for example, right? And that they represent a great opportunity for our ultra low cost carrier partners because, you know, there's just presumably some price sensitive travelers in that region. Problem is that they go to Expedia and they search for flights out of, you know, flights to Las Vegas. Allegiant's not going to show up because those ultra low cost carriers don't show up on those search engines. So we are working to try to figure out how we can make it easier for passengers to have that kind of one-stop shopping experience for flights out of Grand Junction. So we'd really love, I mean, ultimately our dream and vision is to be able to host that on our website where we're just directing them to airline websites so that they're booking with the airline specifically anyway because you have a better travel experience, but that it's a search engine that feels familiar. So like an Expedia or something like that, it feels like that. that's really challenging to do, and but it does. It hasn't stopped us from working, trying to figure out how to do that and finding the right partners. Regardless, we know that we need to improve, you know, the ease to book airline ticket purchases using our airport, and so that's something that we absolutely are working at, how we can accomplish that. And then last, the Air Service Alliance is very focused on marketing the airport, you know, just understanding that there's huge value in that. They have funding available to do that, and they do not have the same restrictions on their marketing efforts that the airport has. We have FAA grant assurances that play in, and that means that we cannot market for a specific airline, things like that. You know, there's a few almost exceptions where if there's new service, we can provide funding to that airline to market that new service. But otherwise, you know, we have to market in a really general sense. The way I would describe it is that our tools for marketing are just, they're a lot more dull than you know, the airlines have or an organization like the Air Service Alliance. So we want to work collaboratively with them to make sure that the marketing that's being done for our airport, that there's consistency and, frankly, teamwork in what we're trying to accomplish.
That's a nice recap, Angela, of our air service piece. I think you've done a nice job here in items 2, 3, 4, and 5 of setting out some goals. I think maybe what we might do, just from a interest of succinctly, is maybe have commissioners look at these just for a moment if they have some questions about the items in 2, 3, 4, and 5. But it looks like a really nice encapsulation of where we might want to be able to go. Actually, some of these might drift into 2023 a little bit too.
Yeah.
So, commissioners, do you see anything up there that you need a little bit more explanation around in those items?
You know, I'm not a big SMART goal guy, but I think when you can put something measurable on there, it would help us in some cases. I don't know, like on 1D, 1E, how you measure those things. I think we get a feel that it's been done. But if there's a way to put a measurement on there that we increase ticket purchases because of our promotion, or just when we can. Like, I don't expect that on 60% of it or 70% of it. I just think if we can and we understand what we're trying to accomplish, it helps us when it comes down to the end. So I think there's a couple other commissioners that are going to bring that up as well. So if you can see a way to do it, I think it may make it more simple for us, but... I get that the majority of those are good goals, the things we want to accomplish. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, good point. There's quantitative and qualitative pieces up there. And it, you know, as we begin to get more traction around what it could look like, maybe we have some sensitivity to that.
I was just going to say, I feel like the 1D and E are almost inputs, and then the measurement is whether or not we exceed our employment budget.
Exactly.
it's kind of hard because we have
how we get there.
At the same level, but those are kind of inputs of things that we're doing to specifically drive that. It's a really good point.
So
like, I didn't present it that way. It almost like needs to be a sub-bullet.
What were those strategies to get there? Yeah.
I mean, that's where, you know, what you see as the goals overall, it's like, you know, okay, how are we going to do that? And it's, you know, we're confident that these things mean, you know, that in this case, you know, A and B are critical, right? That, you know, okay, yes, we are on that growth trajectory. C means that we kind of held our ground and we held our market position in a relative sense. And then D and E, you know, really help drive that. So they work synergistically. It was our intention because I know it is hard. You know, we work in a business where we wish you could measure a lot more than we measure, frankly. Like, we have so little information on our customers. We have so little control over our business. We don't get to decide what airlines fly or where or when. But we do want these to be measurable. Mm-hmm. So actually there's one that we're hoping, you know, you could put some thought to how we could measure it. And that is actually 4B is, you know, maintaining, we're really proud of our employee turnover rates. They're very low. And in this market, I mean, I know there's a lot of organizations where that's not true. And that's their biggest challenge right now. We think it's important. So if there's, you know, that one is measurable. We don't know what the right way of measuring that is. You know, we've looked and said, okay, what if we look and say, okay, we want our turnover rate to remain below our five-year average, right? In today's market, that's success. You know, we could look at those things, but that was something that we were hoping you all could weigh in on.
And I guess the other thing that, given the climate for airlines, focus on profitability and kind of where they're devoting their efforts, is it realistic to think that we can come to the table on a new airline use agreement, lease agreements in 2022?
Or
is that something they asked to push out?
It's something that I think isn't achievable. It's it's a goal that's more of a stretch goal than some of the other ones up there, but I think it's achievable.
Okay. All right.
I guess my only thought on the employee turnover rate is that I personally would rather set it for ourselves than worry about the community or the industry. And if we feel like we lose two people in a year and that's good, then we're meeting that. And if we lose more, then we have a problem. Because you guys have done such a great job, I don't know that you can compare yourselves to anyone else. I mean, if you lost two people, we'd be like, what the heck happened?
Right.
Were they unhappy?
Yeah.
You know, what happened? So I don't, that's just, since you asked. Modernized to me is a hard one for me to measure and understand what that means. But I get what you're trying to get at.
I think that's an electronic version rather than paper.
Okay.
Moving to Excel.
That's it.
For our employees, we have a really, our employees are not employees who love change. None are, right? But like, they work in jobs where it tends to be routine and, you know, you're just waiting to see what's going to happen today. We have a big change right now because we're switching to that annual performance review cycle. And historically, it's been on your anniversary date. And so, especially for our supervisors and things, this feels like a heavy lift. Oh no, all of these at the same time. They're seeing the value in it, but it's just a lot of work. And so that is that modernizing the performance management, starting to create a little bit of separation between, you know, here, please rate your employees and then think about what raise that warrants and, you know, having them be more empowered. And then moving to a state where for next year, you know, their performance management is tied. Some of it is tied directly to department goals. That's never happened, and that's something we're implementing. And so that's what we mean, just to bring to life what that modernize word means. It felt like the appropriate word for us. But
Angela, going back to 4B, part of me wonders about just a couple of things to help you with measurables. Maybe there's an employee satisfaction survey that you do year over year. I don't know. I know you do the reviews, but maybe anonymous? I know Hilltop did that for a while.
Yeah, and that's actually C.
Did I miss that one?
Oh, we're looking
awesome.
To do.
Great. So, I wonder if you don't tie them together then, because I think, I get that it's all under employee engagement, but I do know that satisfaction is tied to turnover, right?
Yeah, I mean, that way they feel like they have a voice.
Yeah. And then, as I always think about this, is the salary compaction right now, the wage compaction, and I don't know how you handle that with your budgeting, but so if there is turnover, you're in a position to compete with the salaries that are crazy right now.
Yeah, and we're trying to stay ahead of that to where we're not losing people because of salaries,
yeah.
Right? And I'm really proud of the job that, you know, our team, and especially Ben and Dylan, have done. Unfortunately, they got a head start on this, and this is something that they worked on before this was a problem everyone else was solving. So
maybe putting that in there as part of that, so you're measuring it, because that's something you can measure, mm-hmm. even though it's hard to keep up with.
And there's a number of tools by which to do that, whether it's Gallup polls or whatever. So there's lots of resources for that. So.
I don't know. Just a thought.
Anything else up there?
No, because they all work together. That's just it.
Thaddeus, you see anything up there you want to?
No, I did have a question about the org chart, and was that actually going to be a different organizational chart? But we went over that.
Okay. Yeah, and I didn't actually touch on the org chart component. You know, we as a leadership team are looking and saying, okay, what are all the job duties we cover? And what departments should they be in?
Yeah.
And making sure they're in the right departments, and if we need to shift things around, we can, right? And you know, that's something that has value in you all knowing, but it has a lot of value to our staff and knowing that we are doing this because it's best for the airport, so it depersonalizes it for people who may be impacted by those org chart changes so that they don't think, oh, it's because of me. It's like, nope, this needs to happen. And so on a global scale, we're looking at this and making sure the right job duties are in the right departments.
Mm-hmm. One thing we talked about with the finance committee was, you know, we might have some positions that aren't filled currently, but we don't really know necessarily what those are, so I don't know if that's a place for that, but when we talked about it was we have three holes here, and then when we look at that, we know we still really want to hire for that position, and that's, you know, a cost that we may have to deal with at some point. But I wouldn't have thought that we were missing that because I don't deal with it every day.
I think some of it's job duties, too, which is more granular. As there was lots of turnover before this leadership team came, people ended up with odds and ends because they split those duties, and then it ended up in weird cases, like ops doing something that maybe makes more sense than admin or vice versa, and I think that's some of it is realigning what makes sense because they've done a good job with it, but it wouldn't normally sit there if you started it from scratch.
And we've done a little bit of that. You know, when I first started here, airport security was in finance. Like, why? You know, so it's those types of things. And Clay, I appreciate you bringing that up because we do have a couple of open positions. And the main reason we haven't filled them is we really want to do this and make sure that we're recruiting for the right position because it's not good for the employee or the organization if you hire someone because they feel like a perfect fit, but then you change their job right away. And so we want to make sure that the job duties are very clear when we're recruiting so that we're filling the gaps that we're seeking to fill, because we think that's best for both of us.
Okay, very good. Ron, anything?
Well, I just maintain employee turnover rate is important to me. I've seen other organizations where you had a low employee turnover, and when the morale, either for morale reasons or for salary reasons, people started leaving. And I think it's important, this my opinion, that you do look at other areas as to what their turnover rate is so that you can compare it. I really do. I think there needs to be some comparison somewhere as far as are you above that or below it. And I can see in this organization, because of your leadership and your leadership team, obviously the morale is high, turnover rate is low. But you want to maintain that, right? I mean, that's the goal.
Yeah, that's a good point, Ron. And I think the exit surveys can be valuable, too.
Yeah, I really do. I think you got to at least look at that because,
that's a good
point. For example, you know, my previous organization, it was kind of interesting. I mean, when you left, you left. And you think they'd want to know why.
Yeah.
Especially now when the turnover rate is a lot higher than when I worked, not because of me, it's because of changing times. Times are changing. But I do believe that is important because institutional memory is important. I mean, when you start losing people that have been working for you for 10 or 15 years and all of a sudden for some reason they decide to leave and you hire somebody new, okay, you are. But look at what it takes to bring that person, he or she, to that level.
Yeah, there's a cost associated with that.
You bet.
Thanks, Ron. Yep. Appreciate that. Anything else that you see on there? No? Okay, good. Early?
I have my questions with the Dwight Silver, of course.
We all have an important role.
That's right. Thank you. Well played. It's been an educational opportunity.
And I know these are more specific than, you know, maybe the board was anticipating. You know, it's I think slightly briefer than last year, but we're trying to keep kind of those five big goals,
yeah.
And then because they're hard to measure, it's how do we, you know, and those goals, these might be our goals for a long time, frankly, year after year, and it's like, how are we achieving those objectives, really, and more measurable goals, you know, supporting goals, basically, mm-hmm. And a lot of those supporting goals are pass-fail, like airline use lease agreements, those kind of things, but hopefully it spells out what we're trying to do this year, that we know of. Because I add that caveat, because to be clear, if like airlines wanted to come here and grow and Avelo wanted to come and start service here, that wasn't on anyone's goal list.
Right.
But of course, we know that that's best for the airport. You know, figuring that out, scrambling to make room for that. And, you know, we don't anticipate any surprises like that this year, but you don't anticipate surprises. So this is what we're planning to do this year.
I don't have any problems.
Cindy? Okay. Dad? Good? Okay.
I'm good.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Thank you for putting the thought. This goes to everybody, part of the staff, management team here, for so much thought in these goals. Sounds like we've got some good suggestions along the way about maybe some quantitative measurements and things of that nature, which we'll discuss a little bit later. So I think that concludes our session, unless there's any other business. Before we go into executive session, I'm going to move that item 8 up in front of 7. And our executive session is strictly our annual review process, where we have a chance to visit with Angela about last year and what we're looking forward for next year. It's a regular scheduled part of our tasks at hand. So, hearing nothing else, I'll entertain a motion for executive session. After the motion is passed, we'll have a 3-minute break for everybody, and then we'll reconvene here for the executive session.
So moved?
Okay.
Oh, do you have to read it? Okay.
So it's on the board up there.
I would be happy to. I'm going to make a motion that we head into executive session pursuant to CRS section 24-6-402, subsection 4F, to discuss personal matters, more specifically to discuss the executive director's annual review and terms of her employment contract.
Thanks. Moved and seconded. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.